Okay, the first case is detention of Black. And I take it the parties are ready.
Yes, good morning. Nancy Collins from the Washington Appellate Project here on behalf of Mark Black. And if I could reserve 3 minutes, please.
Three, okay.
Thank you. Mr. Black was committed under RCW Chapter 7109, which requires the indefinite and often lifelong incarceration of a person. And for that reason, it is this tremendous deprivation of liberty. Makes it particularly important that the procedures and evidence that authorize that commitment ensure that there has been a fair trial. There are several flaws here that require a new trial.
Why don't you start with the trial issue about his presence?
Yes. Well, during jury selection, Mr. Black, who had waived his presence for the first day, was not brought to court by the jail the second day, and some voir dire was conducted in his absence, and defense attorney noted that he had not waived his presence that day.
So we're talking about the 22nd of October.
Yes.
During the morning period when counsel indicated to the court that for reasons that are unexplained, Mr. Black had changed his mind and wanted to be present during the individual questioning of jurors.
Well, no, his waiver had always been for the first day of jury selection.
I understand that, but the record indicates that there was a determination or a representation to the court, I believe it was on the 23rd of September, indicating that he didn't want to be present during individual questioning for strategic reasons.
Yes.
Is that an accurate?
That's correct, yes. Okay. And they had intended that that would just mean the first day. And the court, in introducing the parties the first day of jury selection, said, Mr. Black's not going to be here today, but he'll be here tomorrow. You will meet him then.
Sure, okay. And then at that point, when he, for reasons, administrative reasons, apparently they didn't get him from the jail, he was not present.
That's correct.
Nevertheless, individual questioning of jurors proceeded.
That's correct.
And that's your point.
That is, yes, okay. Yes. And if this were a criminal case, that there's no question that would be a fundamental deprivation of his right to.
So the question is, in this civil case, yes, whether or not there's a problem, and I take it you, by your briefing, you're characterizing it as a due process problem.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Exactly. The criminal standards don't apply in all contexts in these 7109 proceedings, but many of those fundamental rights are carried over because of the tremendous deprivation of liberty at stake in this unique and special proceeding, as our Supreme Court has characterized these.
Okay, if we set aside your reliance on Irby, which is a criminal case, and talk about due process, then the case that we're really talking about is Matthews versus Eldridge, right?
Yes, that does.
That's a civil case, and it talks about when due process has satisfied.
That is our basic balancing test that we apply in these cases.
So if we apply Matthews here, what result?
Well, you know, in weighing those factors that Matthews has, you know, everyone, I think there's no dispute that the deprivation of liberty requires a heightened protections in 7109 cases generally. The state had every intention of bringing him to court that day. It was a mix-up with the jail, apparently, that didn't bring him in, so there's no great burden on them to bring him to court. That was the plan, that he would be here, as the court had told the jurors in advance. So ultimately, it comes to weighing, you know, what's at stake here. And then, as we have recognized, you know, generally in civil cases, people have the right to be present during jury selection and to participate, as our criminal court rules contemplate, and expressly criminal court rule 47, or civil court rule, I'm sorry, 47 says that the parties have the right to question jurors, which would include the individual being present and advising a lawyer. And then it is, you know, selecting a jury is a very important part of any case. You know, social scientists, you know, will say generally that mix up. And as Irby recognized, in its assessment of, you know, the harmfulness of the error, that one juror can certainly make a difference, and that it's very important that you have that ability to weigh in on that individual selection. So under that theory, the reasoning of Irby, although putting aside the standard, supports the importance of Mr. Black's personal participation and especially when, you know, he was promised to be there. The jurors would certainly wonder why he wasn't there. The judge, in explaining to the jurors why they were cutting off the voir dire early, early that day and adjourning. She was seems very frustrated just from her words on the page, and says it's not any fault of anyone in the courtroom here. It's not someone here's fault, which, you know, left open the fact that it was potentially Mr. Black's own fault, that he's for some reason causing some disturbance, and that's why he's not brought here today, and he's the reason why we have to delay proceedings and make jury selection last longer than necessary. So that also, harmed Mr. Black's right, it infringed upon his right to be there. For those reasons, I think that not letting him take part in jury selection is a fundamental error based on the nature of the case, and as our courts have protected that individual right. And this is a unique situation where, unlike most civil cases, Mr. Black has no ability to control his ability to come to court. So other civil cases don't really address that fact because he is in jail, and it is the state's custody that he depends on to be brought to court, which is why it's more akin to criminal setting standard.
You want to talk about hemophilia?
Yeah, I do. I want to bring that up, and I will note that the state and I both gave some supplemental authority yesterday a couple of recent cases. The Illinois Supreme Court has a current case that assesses the DSM-5's rejection of hemophilia, but the real problem here is that the court, the court said, I agree that hemophilia is not a generally accepted theory and doesn't have the reliable methodology that Fry requires. But if you call it something else, paraphilia NOS, with a certain label, then that is accepted. And that's inconsistent and incongruous and not supported by the literature. It is a de novo review, and it is fundamentally important that someone is committed only based on a serious mental disorder, as our U.S. Supreme Court said in Kansas versus Hendricks, and that's a fundamental part of making this kind of commitment constitutional, to draw that line between someone who's a recidivist and someone who has that mental abnormality causing them to commit behavior which they cannot control. And that's why that is necessary to... I'll just finish my thought here. And that's why it's necessary to really apply that standard accurately. The court did have a Fry hearing here, but the ultimate ruling, barring Mr. Black from even mentioning and cross-examining the expert on hemophilia, undercut the fairness of his trial.
When you come back, you might want to think about whether the record distinguishes between hemophilia and the diagnosis that was done in this case.
Good morning. May it please the court. Andrea Vitalich from the King County Prosecutor's Office on behalf of the respondent, the state of Washington. We'd ask this court to affirm Mr. Black's commitment as a sexually violent predator. I will also begin with the issue of Mr. Black's absence for half of a day for some limited procedures that took place during jury selection. First, I just want to be really clear about this. It seemed particularly in the reply brief, Mr. Black was assuming that the state was arguing that civil litigants don't have some sort of right to be present for jury selection. That's not my argument. My argument is that right stems from due process, and it appears that we're all on the same page about that this morning. So therefore, assuming the error was preserved, which is still our position it was not, the relevant test would be the Matthews versus Elledge test. In this case, the key under the Matthews test, in my estimation, is factor two, which is what was the risk of the erroneous deprivation of liberty given what occurred in this case. And that risk in this particular instance is non-existent, because what took place in the morning on the second day of jury selection were the exact same procedures that took place on the first day of jury selection, when Mr. Black had specifically waived his presence, apparently. And that would be individual questioning of jurors, which Judge Cox noted his presence was waived for that for strategic reasons. And the other two procedures that took place on both of those days were hardship excusals, which is an administrative function of the trial court, and some for cause challenges and for cause excusals, none of which were objected to. So.
Well, that's true. There was a lot going on here. The trial court was trying to move the proceedings along efficiently. Counsel participated in the questioning of jurors. But nonetheless, assuming there was a preservation of this claim, there were judgments being made in Mr. Black's absence about who ultimately, A, would either sit on the jury or, B, not sit on the jury. Even if those same procedures on the second day were the same as the first, selection of the jury, particularly in this situation, was sort of an important part of the trial. And in his absence, he had no ability to have input into who ultimately was going to either sit or not sit on the jury. So under factor two, why is that not important?
Well, I would somewhat disagree with Your Honor's characterization of Mr. Black's ability to have input as to who sits and who doesn't sit on the jury. Again, given this record, the fact that the jurors who were excused, either for hardship, which again is administrative, or for cause, which both attorneys participated in on both days, and none of it was objected to, what really was at issue in this case was the fact that the trial court wanted to press forward with general voir dire and finish voir dire on day two. And that was the point at which both defense counsel interjected and said, no, Mr. Black needs to be here. We need his input on the selection of the jury. And at that point, the trial court acceded, okay, that's reasonable. Finished up with hardship excusals and some remaining individual questioning, and a couple of jurors were excused because they didn't have sufficient language skills. And then everyone was excused until the following day, when the real meat of jury selection began, which is general questioning by the parties, the exercise of peremptory challenges, which is the point at which certainly Mr. Black gave his input as to who specifically should be sitting on his jury, and then the jury was impaneled. So,
again, it's your position that he had no role to play at the point where he objected to his absence in the proceeding?
Well, again, the record demonstrates that the objection was not specifically interposed until
let's assume
court.
I disagree with you. Let's
right.
assume that I look at the minute entry on the morning of 10/22, and it says that counsel objected to his absence from the proceeding. Let's just assume that for purposes
right.
of discussion. I take it it's your position that he had no role or no meaningful role to play from that point forward.
Well, it's not that he wouldn't have a role. It's that the question would be, was his role on the first day vis-a-vis his role on half of the second day, given the procedures undertaken were exactly the same, is so fundamental that there would be a risk of an erroneous deprivation of liberty under factor two of the Matthews test. There would also be factor three, which in this case would mean that although jurors were excused for both hardship and cause on day one without objection from anyone, with Mr. Black's presence having been waived, we're going to hang on to all of those people from day two and bring them back and employ those same procedures in Mr. Black's presence, even though they occurred on the first day without him, because somehow that will make a difference. And that procedure would be a burden on that system. So under factors two and three. Obviously, factor one is generally not at issue in these cases, but factor two in particular.
As to factor three, though, governmental interest, administrative burden, cost, at noon the court said, yeah, let's stop the process. This isn't like the objection, the due process concern is going to trigger some hearing or some additional proceeding that is going to take a lot of time or a lot of energy from the parties or involvement of the government. It's just, are we going to wait till he can get here from the jail before we go forward? What governmental interest is there in going forward without him being present?
Well, again, if you look at the record from the morning on day two, which again were the same procedures as occurred on day one, there were a number of jurors who were questioned individually. There were some jurors who were excused for hardship. And there were some jurors who were excused for cause, some based on challenge, some sua sponte, but none objected to. So taking all of those proceedings, which again also occurred on day one, and bringing all of those people back and doing all of those procedures again would be a burden. The The recess that took place in this case was prior to general voir dire, once again, which is the meat of the jury selection process and the point at which counsel insisted that Mr. Black should be present and give his input on which jurors should be challenged and which jurors should sit. And that's what occurred here. So again, questioning particularly factor two, what is the risk of the erroneous deprivation of liberty under these circumstances? How has there been a due process violation? And I would just note that what the record shows vis-a-vis the clerk's notes is that that took place off the record, and it was not an objection. It was a notification to the trial court.
Why does it make any difference if it was made but off the record?
Because preservation of error requires a specific objection on the record, and that's not what occurred in this case.
So because the minute entry says an objection was made and the report of proceedings does not, that means that we cannot look at the actual...
Well, I would have to go back and look at the precise language, but I don't believe the clerk's minute says an objection was made. It says that counsel informs the court that Mr. Black is not present and has not waived his presence. I believe that's what it says.
Let's talk about hebephilia.
Turning to that issue, Your Honor, as I explained in my brief, it's not necessary for this court to make a determination as to whether that's a valid diagnosis or not, because it's our contention that based on this particular record, and specifically the testimony of the defense's own expert pretrial, that there is a significant difference between the term hemophilia as it was used in this case and the diagnosis that Dr. Arnold actually made.
In your briefing, you rely on some language in DSM-5 to make that point.
Correct. And in the ICD-10.
Okay. Both. Let's set ICD-10 aside. Dr. Arnold, your expert, did his diagnosis on the basis of DSM-4.
Correct.
DSM-4 apparently does not have the same language that you point to in DSM-5. What effect does that have in your argument?
None, because the difference between the two is that the diagnosis under DSM-4-TR would be paraphilia not otherwise specified, and then the specifier that Dr. Arnold stated, which is sexually attracted to pubescent-age females. And under the DSM-5, it is simply called other specified paraphilic disorder. But the diagnosis is the same. It's a change in terminology between the DSM-4-TR and the DSM-5. In addition, DSM-5 is a little bit more specific as to the difference between merely a paraphilia and a paraphilic disorder, but the diagnoses are the same under either of those two documents. And it's interesting with the DSM. The DSM states that essentially a paraphilia is any sexual fixation or interest in anything other than sexual activity with a consenting physically mature partner can be classified as a paraphilia. These children were not physically mature.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me turn to the hemophilia issue and reiterate that Dr. Arnold did say, explaining the basis of this diagnosis that he had created, that it was based on the same science as hemophilia, that he says that he, using this name because the DSM-5 had rejected hemophilia, but he was drawing on the same research that the DSM work group had considered and rejected in adopting hemophilia, and not even putting it on the sort of the back burner for something to consider further, that they didn't even take that intermittent step. They said, no, we don't believe that there's enough methodology, reliability, enough study of this to give it that kind of credence. And as this court said in the Lake Chelan homeowners case in discussing Fry, that an expert's method doesn't withstand Fry if it's based on his own practice. And that's essentially what we have here is Dr. Arnold saying, well, I think that I can rejigger this a bit based on my own clinical experience and give it a different diagnosis. But as the U.S. Supreme Court said in Kansas versus Hendricks, that it is important that the disorder is one that the psychiatric profession classifies as a serious mental disorder, and that has not occurred yet. has not occurred at all in terms of this diagnosis, as the trial court recognized here. And, you know, as Justice Wiggins said in his dissenting opinion in Meyerhofer, and although it's a dissent, the majority didn't reach the issue, this disorder should not be recognized when the American psychiatric community has not done so in speaking of hebephilia. Which underscores the fact that the trial court was correct that Dr. Franklin, who was a credible expert, had presented valid concerns about that the psychiatric community at large had on this diagnosis. Dr. Arnold was basing his diagnosis on the same science, and even if the theory might be one that Dr. Arnold embraces, there is no question that the methodology has not been subject to the kind of testing and approval that is required for a disorder to be the basis of a civil commitment, which is why a new trial is required here, because although there are other diagnoses offered, this was the focal point, and also Mr. Black was not permitted to cross-examine or even mention this diagnosis when trying to undercut Dr. Arnold's diagnosis on cross-examination, which is another reason why Mr. Black should have a new trial where the diagnosis that the state offers is one that passes that Frye test. And if no remaining questions, we ask that you order a new trial.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.